You're listening to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Bear. Heaven help us, the school year is just a few weeks away. And if you're anything like me, you feel like you are woefully out of the loop on what the school year is going to look like for your kids amid a global pandemic. Well, you're not alone. Not that this will make you feel any better, though, but many teachers don't know what learning will look like either, and they're just as worried as you are. Here to talk about what they do know and what teachers are considering going into the fall is Matinga Ragatz, an education consultant and frequent contributor on Stateside. Matinga, welcome.
Thank you, Laura.
Also joining us, Rick Joseph. He's with Birmingham Covington School. He teaches fifth grade and sixth grade language arts and social studies. Rick, welcome.
Hi, Laura. It's great to be with you.
And Kara Lougheed. She's an English and history teacher at Stony Creek High School in Rochester Hills. Kara, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, Matinga, I was riding bikes with my family over the weekend. We drove up to the elementary school where my daughter is slated to start kindergarten. And I noticed a series of red X's spaced out conspicuously at 6 feet apart, leading up to basically each of the doors, each of the entrances to each of the classrooms. And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, here it comes. This is the beginning of schools really planning what it's going to take logistically to get kids into the classroom. What are you hearing from teachers and administrators about the summer planning process for the great unknown?
Yeah, the great unknown is right. Now, one thing, her being in kindergarten, she just will not know any different. So it was actually be just as exciting and just as fun for her because she won't know what life used to be like. But, you know, I work nationally, so there's a wide spectrum of what's happening, you know, based on what's happening on the ground. Administrators are making decisions based on, like, their resources, the access to personnel, logistical variables. And I can tell you, there's not one teacher, not one administrator in the state of Michigan that has not been doing this like Rubik's Cube type logistical analyses of all of this. So you know that when they open the doors, they are going to be safe. They're going to be okay, in a sense.
Kara, let's talk, Kara and Rick, let's talk a little bit about what this looks like that could be different on an age-to-age basis, grade-to-grade. When I look and I see articles about the potential of outdoor learning and trying to get outside more, where we know it's more safe than being isolated in a classroom with several people, I think to myself, this makes sense for my young kindergartner that she would do really well learning outside. Now, that might not be true for every student, but I also think that would be much more true for a younger child than for, say, a high schooler who has to move around a school by subject. So, Rick, let's start with you. What do you think about what makes most sense for the sort of late elementary, middle school aged kids?
Well, I think most of the plans, if not all the plans globally, of course, focus on three considerations. One, if there is to be in-person instruction, then in-person instruction needs to take place with mask wearing, physical distancing, and frequent hand washing. So the opportunity to have any kind of instruction outside would certainly be possible. There are things that we can do in an outdoor space that would approximate what we could do in the classroom. There certainly would be some limitations, but it is definitely an option.
And Kara, how about at the high school level? It seems like there is going to be a logistical nightmare, no matter what you're talking about, whether it's transportation or trying to keep first graders wearing masks all day long. But in high school, you're talking about kids generally are moving around all day anyway, and they're not outside for recess. They're very much focused in on studies. So what are the issues that are being discussed at the high school level in Rochester Hills?
So being outside, it kind of makes me chuckle because when I take my seniors out for reading time, sometimes they like it if it's not too hot, not too cold, not too windy, not, mm-hmm. you know, so it's like, it's a whole different world and they do move hour to hour. But just the way that high schools, especially high schools in Oakland County, which is where Rochester is, they are overfilled. Like, they are crowded to max capacity. I think Lake Orion has well over 2,000 students in the school. And so to talk about how to space them, how to move them, where to put them to keep them safe. Sure, going outside for a few classes when you can is a nice idea. But like you said, so much of what we do is just going to be a logistical nightmare trying to get these kids through the hallways. They move through the hallways, depending on schedules, 4 to 5, 6 times a day. And I don't know if you've been in a high school during passing time recently. I don't recommend it.
Yeah.
It's crowded.
Packed to the gills. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm hearing all kinds of plans, but I was talking to Matinga the other day and a lot of it just feels like nonsense. I just don't know how it would work.
I'm going to ask both Kara and Rick the same question, which is, with just a few weeks really remaining until school starts, do you feel like teachers are prepared for come what may? Kara first.
No. Every group that I am in, every group chat, every Facebook page, on my Twitter feed, no. I mean, they're not prepared to go back to fully full classrooms. I teach U.S. history, and I routinely have anywhere from 32 to 38 students in my classroom. And right now there's not a plan to reduce that number other than offering a virtual option. So that potentially could, if some students chose to stay home, but I don't know what I'm supposed to do going back with full classrooms, full hallways. There's a lot of talk out there about teachers being reluctant to go back, but what I think a lot of people in the public don't realize is that it's not that we're nervous to go back just because of this virus. We're nervous to go back because history has shown us that when schools can't afford something or can't provide something, that falls on teachers and other school staff. And so if you want us to go back, I think we need to feel safe, and no one is feeling like they're going to be safe. That's been my perception. I'll let Rick kind of pick up there.
Yeah, Rick Joseph from Birmingham Covington School.
Laura, to answer your question, I wouldn't say there's a teacher in this country that feels comfortable going back to school in the fall because of all the things that Kara mentioned, of course, and the fact that not only are there so many unknowns and so many variables, even our plans articulate three considerations. One, we go back with masks, physical distancing, and frequent hand washing. Two, we go back in a hybrid setting that combines in-person instruction with online learning. Or three, exclusive online learning. And as Kara said, districts' plans that I've seen basically give parents the choice. And when we've taken surveys of not only the parent population, but the teacher population, and said, okay, how many of you feel comfortable going back 100% in-person instruction? How many would like to do a hybrid, and how many want to stay at home? And the numbers that I've seen hover maybe around 50%, 20 to 50% of parents say they want their kid to be virtual. Now, all of that can change depending on the behavior of the virus. And if you look at the numbers in Oakland County, we're into a second wave. So we don't know what's going to happen in a week, a month, 2 months. So no, nobody feels like we're at all comfortable going back to school, because not only are the plans uncertain and how they would work in real life, there are so many variables there, but the virus itself is constantly evolving and changing. So we have never faced a situation that has so many unknowns, so many variables. So it's a time of incredible uncertainty.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Rick Joseph and Kara Lougheed. They are teachers considering what's going to happen this fall amid COVID. We've also been speaking with Matinga Ragatz, an education consultant who frequently joins us on this program. Matinga Ragatz, you know, I can't help but think that this is going to require, no matter what, where we start the school year, it's going to require teachers, administrators, and districts as a whole being, and parents and kids, of course, in that mix as well, being extremely nimble as the year progresses. We can't just start with one set of ideas and expect that that's where we're going to end the school year as well. Is that where you would say that everybody's got to be mentally, that we have to be nimble and pivot throughout the year to whatever is going to work that month or that week?
For sure. You know, as a community, I think we need to really ask ourselves what the purpose of school is. So right now, we as educators know that the learning environment not only provides that, you know, safety net for the child's mental health, the correct learning environment, but it also induces learning. So now just taking the kids and putting them in a building is not learning. So this idea that, man, if you just kind of take them to school so they can learn, or they're going to be behind if they're not in school, it's just nonsensical in my opinion. So the community really needs to understand that we are, like Rick said, this is an emergency. This is almost like we're at war with this virus. So the first thing we need to do is make sure our communities and our kids are safe, and then worry about their academic development. So their physical development and their mental development is very important, but their academic development needs to take a back seat right now so that we can get this done and done well.
There is this perhaps defeatist sort of vibe out there among some parents, and I'm curious how this might spread to educators as well, that maybe we should be considering this nearly a lost year for most kids, and that just getting through is going to be as much success as we can hope for, and advancing children in their learning is maybe not a realistic expectation. Matinga, do you think that that is overly glass half empty on this one?
I agree with the parents, and I agree with the notion that this is not a lost year, because there's a lot of learning opportunities during a pandemic, but it is definitely not normal, and it's not business as usual. So as a community of educators, we understand that this is an opportunity for us to pivot the entire education system. This is an opportunity to really understand disparities, equity, and especially what exactly our purpose is in schools. And I think that this culture of always asking teachers to fix the social issues has made it really difficult for us to stay on script. And so a lot of us find it really easy to lose the plot, and suddenly you're asking the schools to feed the children, to take care of their mental health, when really we're not set up for that. And like Kara said so eloquently, we don't have the funding for that. And I can tell you, I'm an educator, but I'm not a psychologist. So to ask me to take care of your child's mental health goes above and beyond my training.
Mm-hmm. Kara Lougheed, when I talk about a lost year or think about a lost year for my kindergartner, it's a lot different than talking about a lost year for a high schooler. Tell me a little bit what weighs on you when you think about the potential of just not making much headway or losing ground with high schoolers.
So I hear what parents are saying, and I have a high schooler myself. I have one going into 10th grade, and then I have one going into 7th grade. And I don't think any year is ever a lost year. I think that there's always opportunities to learn and read and grow and have discussion. What I'm concerned about is that if we go forward with plans to keep class sizes where they are, that's my concern, because these kids are going to need more connection, because we might see them fewer days. If you go into a hybrid model where maybe you only have half the kids a couple of days, to me, that actually presents some really good opportunities to get to know a smaller group of kids. Because what happens is, when I have 36 in a room for 1 hour a day, I get to know as many of them as I can. And I know all of their names, and I know I'm trying to know at least something interesting about each one of them. But that's, five times a day. So that's a lot of kids. And if we're in a global pandemic and they already have anxiety and they're already fearful and they have all these classes on top of that, if I had a smaller group a couple days and then I connected with them online on other days, I just feel like that would be one way to mitigate some of this, is if we were allowed to really connect with kids in a little bit smaller groups, and maybe we can just move through the things that are most important to learn. We do things in school sometimes, we have they call them like power standards, and you can pick and choose some things that are really important for kids to learn, and then it's not a lost year. Maybe you didn't get to do as many things as you wanted to, but there's still room for growth in high school, and I think kids would be even more hungry for it if they were given an opportunity to really connect with their teachers in a smaller, more intimate setting.
Rick Joseph, before we wrap up here, I wanted to ask you about the idea of the different ways that students might learn. There's an idea out there floating around that if you are able in any way to keep your children home, perhaps the best thing to do as a parent is to make the decision your child will learn from home, virtually or homeschooling, and give the opportunity to kids who have parents who are essential workers or have the greatest needs to be in a classroom setting, give those kids the advantage that they need by being in the classroom. That raises all sorts of questions about who might be left behind, who would take advantage of those opportunities, and how some kids might advance over others in the classroom. What crosses your mind when you think about the kids who are most vulnerable, who either will or will not be able to take advantage of the classroom setting?
That's a really good question, Laura, because it speaks to the heart of the issue of equity, which is really fundamentally about making sure that kids get what they need. I have had students who, when we were doing virtual learning for the fourth quarter of the school year in the springtime, kids who thrived in an in-person experience floundered at home, and vice versa. Kids who struggled mightily in person were thriving at home. So it's an interesting question. It's a question that really has to be answered on a case-by-case basis and on a family-by-family basis. But it also speaks to what Matinga and Kara have both alluded to in terms of reducing class sizes, in terms of providing the resources that we need. Because if we're going to effectively educate our kids in an equitable manner, we need to have the resources. We need to have the funding. We need to have the personnel. And we need to prioritize education as it stands now. Some schools in Saginaw, Flint, Detroit, Benton Harbor, that's the social service safety net for the entire community. And there's healthcare, there's feeding programs, there's education, but there's so much that a school is. And that's a problem, because that means that there's been a failure of other components of the community when your school is the be all and the end all for the health, the overall health of a group of people. So it depends on the families, but I do think that's an important consideration. There certainly has been talk that people with special needs ought to be in an in-person setting, because it's very problematic to learn online. It's incredibly inefficient. It's slow and cumbersome, and not everybody can do it.
That was Rick Joseph. He's a language arts and social studies teacher with Birmingham Covington School, and he's a former Teacher of the Year, as well as Kara Lougheed. She's an English and history teacher at Stony Creek High School in Rochester Hills, also a former Teacher of the Year, and Matinga Ragatz. She's an education consultant who joins us frequently to talk about education issues on Stateside. Thank you all for joining us, and you know, good luck this fall. We're thinking, all of us parents are thinking about all of you teachers, so thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks, Laura.